Welcome to Building Remotely, the podcast where we talk with founders and leaders of remote companies. Together with them, we aim to uncover hidden insights that you can use when building a startup remotely. I'm your host, Sondre, the founder and CEO of SafetyWing, a Y Combinator-backed startup building a global social safety net for remote workers. Let's begin. When I think about the future of remote work, everything is so instantaneous and fast. It feels like the tools melt away. And it feels like when you think about the past week, if you're a hybrid worker, you may not remember which days you were in the office and which days you were remote because they feel so comparable. And I actually don't think that's 10 years out. I think we'll get there very soon. In this episode, I'm joined by Rajiv Iyengar, the CEO and co-founder of Tandem, a virtual office for remote teams. Welcome to Building Remotely, Rajiv.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Together with Rajiv, we will discuss the problems people face trying to build together remotely, and specifically the advent of solutions to these problems, like his company Tandem. So just before, when we were talking just now, Rajiv, you shared an interesting story about a theme in your life that led you up to this moment of founding Tandem. Could you share that theme?
I've always loved these moments of shared inspiration, you know, where you're talking with somebody and all of a sudden the light bulb goes off. I remember it in college working on problem sets at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and then all of a sudden you get this unlock. It's just an amazing feeling. And fast forward, this is sort of how my co-founders and I started a company together. And it was, we were not working on Tandem initially. We were working on a cryptocurrency project, but it all started with us just brainstorming in a coffee shop. We used to meet every couple of months in Phil's Coffee in Noe Valley. And one meeting, we just, something clicked. We had this idea and it wasn't Tandem. It was something else, but we had this idea and it was strong enough that we decided to jump and start this company together. And I've always loved those moments. Long story short, we started on a different idea. We pivoted a few times. We became a remote company when both my co-founders had kids. And we started feeling like we weren't getting those moments of shared inspiration as much, not nearly as much when we were remote. So we started building something to recover that. And maybe to get a little bit, you know, sappy, this is one of the things I love about Tandem, that these moments of shared inspiration happen on Tandem now, and they happen for other teams, teams around the world. So, you know, the next big idea could come from people who just had an idea on Tandem, hopped into a room, talked with a teammate, and just went from there.
I very much can relate to that. I always used to think that my favorite feeling was sort of eureka moment, the insight, which is a personal inspiration or insight moment. But, you know, when it's shared, you know, that's just even better, you know, when you can get those moments when you discover something as you're talking or working on something. So I would definitely sign up for more of those moments. So you mentioned that you were kind of, you know, had this crypto project, some of your own problems that you discovered. Could you maybe sketch out what were some of those problems you discovered and that you're working on addressing?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we went from working in person every day. We used to work at each other's houses. We used to bring around our own whiteboards so we could brainstorm wherever we were. We loved that, just jamming on ideas. And so when we went remote, we found a couple things. We felt more disconnected. When somebody had an idea, often it's just a while before you could talk to somebody. We found that we weren't talking as much, and that was leading to less alignment on what we were working on. And we just didn't feel like a team anymore. There was this more emotional impact of you don't have this sense of somebody working with you as much anymore. And it's interesting because we had all been on or led remote teams in the past. We weren't unfamiliar with remote work, but having just worked as co-founders in a really early stage startup, you need this level of closeness. And so we experienced this transition all of a sudden, and it caused us to ask, like, well, how do we recover this sense of serendipity, of collaboration? And it wasn't like we dreamed up Tandem overnight. We went through four or five iterations of trying to deconstruct what it was that gave us this sense of, you know, being a team together. And it was really simple in the end. It was a sense of presence, this sense of who's around, who's free to talk, what they're working on, what they're doing, and then removing the friction to talking, just making it so easy to talk, just like you're tapping somebody on the shoulder. Mm. And so for context, you know, Tandem, we describe it as a virtual office for remote teams. Mm. You know, I think the category of a virtual office we've seen coming for a while, and it's now having its moment. But what it means functionally is it's a desktop app that you can see who's around and you can talk in one click. Mm-hmm. And that's so simple and yet so powerful.
Okay. So that thing you're talking about there, I mean, the lack of presence, I can confirm from Safe Doings history. Because my previous startup was remote, I kind of knew what I was getting into. And we oversolved it in the beginning when we were like four people on the team. We had Google Meets open like all day, every day.
Yeah.
All the time, which has, you know, a tremendous cost and can be very intense. So, you know, eventually we let that go. But we were, you know, incredibly aware of this presence that you're describing. When it's gone, people feel like they're working alone. And I experienced that previously, which is that even when you have pretty good collaboration, if people don't know that other people are working, they kind of start to get this feeling that I'm the only one doing anything because that's all they see, themselves doing anything. And it was for that reason that we started using this, you know, please forgive me, but awful software, Sococo, which was our previous kind of virtual office solution. But it was the only one that it had even tried, you know, back then, which is, you know, years ago.
Yeah, you know, there's something I actually want to double click on there, which is really interesting, which is you don't see other people talking. So social proof is a big thing. If you're aware that other people are talking, you're more likely to talk. So when you think about the group phenomenon of in a remote team, how comfortable do people feel talking, pulling a third person into the conversation, having group conversations? A big factor and something that people underestimate is just how visible these conversations are. Mm. So if you're in a world, you know, pre-virtual office, if you're not using a virtual office and you're using Slack and Zoom and Calendar, right? Everybody may be talking constantly. And in fact, often they are, because if you're scheduling meetings, you need to fill up the whole day with meetings. Everybody's talking all the time and nobody sees anybody talking.
Yeah.
So you feel the sense of aloneness, even though you're talking to people all the time. Because I'm wondering, you know, is Vivi talking to Tim?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I know in theory, probably they have a one-on-one scheduled, but I don't see them at all. And one of the things that's so powerful that people, you know, I think it's subconscious at first, but people start to comment on is it's just really nice to see other people talking in tandem. It's like, I know when Tim and Bernat are having a one-on-one. I know if Bernat's late to my brainstorm because he's just finishing up something in the one-on-one and I see him with Tim and it turns this feeling of before a virtual office, I may be like, where's Bernat? I'm alone and blind and I don't know where Bernat is. And is he standing me up? And is he late? Is he okay? Mm. Whereas now I'm like, oh, I see him. He's talking with Tim. I'm like happy that he's talking with Tim.
Exactly.
Turns this confusion to something more positive and social.
I think this is a great insight because there is information there that, you know, if I see Sarah is late for a meeting and I see her talking to Jared, I can usually guess exactly what they're talking about as well. And, you know, it's like I then know that is being addressed, right? Because I might know.
Yeah, it's great, right?
Yeah, it's great. And it's information. It's not just comforting or consoling. It's information that is really relevant because if they aren't talking to each other, you know, that might be a problem.
Yeah. There's a second or third order communication, which is the meta communication. Like it's not enough. And this is why, like, let's say you have a strategy, you want to share something on the company strategy to the team. It's not enough to tell everybody one-on-one because it's also important that they know everybody else knows this fact.
Yes.
Right? That's the second or third order communication. And that's why we have these group conversations and you can't do everything just in one-on-ones.
Oh, yes. That is actually another one. And we do those, you know, we just had the other day, what we call the town hall. And you're absolutely right. Like we bring up things on the town hall that everyone knows, for example. But the reason is that exactly like you said, is this, well, you called it something else, third or fourth order communication. But I tend to think of the word common knowledge, if you heard about that word from Steven Pinker.
Yes.
Yeah. And I find that such a useful way to think about it because when something is common knowledge, you expect other people to know it too. You can reference it. And that's what's so useful about it. Like it's this reference you can also hold people to and make. And it becomes this like node that we can communicate around.
we're getting up onto the topic of, I don't want to go out of order, but we're getting on the topic of transparency. And like, I think this sense of common knowledge is why transparency is so powerful in a team or in a company. And it's one of the things that's very hard to do when you're remote and you don't have these group conversations and team conversations.
Okay, so I'm starting to get a picture now of the problems that we're trying to solve. And it's transparency. You can see who's working, you see who's talking to each other. They are more available, they have lower friction. And you're sort of addressing that, which is a problem that many companies who have just gone remote, I suppose they don't know that they have those problems right away. Do you have that experience?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that often they think about what are the things they need to replace directly from the office. It's usually meetings, like, great, we got Zoom for meetings. Mm-hmm. We've taken meetings and we've made them virtual. But there's a whole bunch of other things that come along with that. The hallway conversations, to and from meetings, the water cooler moments, the ability to pop out of a meeting room and pull in a third person. Like, all of these things are actually quite difficult to replicate with conventional tools unless you have this category of the virtual office. And I think the simplest way of thinking about the problem is that there's higher friction to talk and people don't know who's free, so people don't talk as much. The interesting things that emerge from that, the emergent properties of these problems are, you could call it less transparency and less trust at the organizational level.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And as we all know, like intuitively and through lots of research, trust is speed.
So this is actually the road to speed. The path to speed is to increase the trust and transparency in your organization. And then you need to replace the office as well as the meeting room. Okay, so I just had this reference from like way back in my history that I'm going to, you know, take a chance to bring up now, because I'm realizing as I'm listening to you speak that I made some of these learnings many years ago. And I remember you talked about a comparison to esports and gaming at some places I was researching this. And some of these things I remember I had made the lessons way back in the days, in the, you know, 2000s, playing various kind of MMORPG games. There was a text-based one. We had these alliances. You know, it was a lot like building a company today. And we learned many of these things the hard way, you know, and became friends online. And many of the things that we did then, we're now doing in Safety Wing. We're like literally doing the same thing that we were just doing for fun.
What kinds of things?
I mean, first I have to take some of the big basics that everyone does. So one, we used IRC and now we use Slack in like largely the same way. And two, we made bots for IRC to kind of relay information that was relevant from the game into the channels. Mm-hmm. And now we do the exact same thing in Slack. So those are two biggies. And then another one, you know, that we did a lot in gaming and Alliance is that you have to build up this almost like fun world of symbols and mythology. I mean, we did that in the alliances back then. And I found it to be, you know, incredibly entertaining, but also like really useful. So, you know, we're doing a lot of that in Safety Wing. Like we have this whole world with the birds and the illustrations. And we spend a lot of time with like art and we relay to this in like interesting ways. And we do it all for fun. But I do think it is useful in a way as well. So that's a surprise one.
The world of online gaming gives us such an insight into the future. And the other thing I think that we could mention is gamers making friends on voice chat while playing games.
Yes.
Ventrilo, TeamSpeak, now Discord. And one of the reasons I think this is really significant for us, you know, we were looking at Discord as an inspiration very early on. Your friends on Discord, the analogy is they're your teammates in at work. Instead of multiplayer games, you have multiplayer collaborative apps like Figma, Notion, Google Docs. And one of the biggest questions, I mean, you've been remote for a while, so you know, you have this a very privileged view on how much team cohesion can form, how much team trust can form, how you form close relationships with people remotely. But for the rest of the world that's just gone remote, you know, I think there's still this animating question of, sure, you can maintain trust when you're remote, if you know the people, but what do you do with new employees? What do you do with new team members? What do you do if you're the first person at a company? Can you actually form the same level of trust and relationships that you would in person? Hmm. And the thing that, you know, gave us a lot of confidence that, yes, you can totally do this is looking at, you know, entire generations of kids and teenagers who had grown up making friends around the world, playing games and talking on Discord.
Yeah.
And if you can form those relationships, absolutely you can form relationships with people you're working with. The analogy is very similar. It's like you're doing something, you're creating something together. It's competitive, it's creative, it's difficult, it's collaborative. And then you're working in multiplayer apps and talking with tools like the virtual offices.
So given our success in gaming, in building relationship and collaborating remotely, years ago, we see sort of professional lives, you know, still hang behind. Is there something about professional collaboration that makes it more difficult?
You know, I think the demographics are very different. Mm. The level of seriousness is something that maybe creates some friction to talking or expressing yourself. Although we're finding teams are much more open to fun and playfulness than many people think. But I do think there's some ways in which it's actually easier to form relationships at work. And, you know, of course, some of my closest friendships are, you know, through work. And one of those things is just, hey, you have hard problems to solve together. And there's just a lot of overlap time. We're all working at roughly the same times. And that just creates a good setting for forming relationships. But of course, you have hierarchies. You know, you don't necessarily choose everybody that you work with. There are lots of things that make it a little bit more difficult to form relationships. Mm. And the translation of office culture to online culture is still not quite there. So we're still figuring it out, I think.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to the seriousness point. Many things that I, you know, as a teenager, you know, we just figured it out somehow. You know, when we made a tool, we would like look at a script, kind of learn it by making it, both things you would today call like scraper and, you know, various bot. And people today, everything is so serious and then it becomes so difficult because it has to be done so properly all the time. And when you have to do things so incredibly properly, then they also become so difficult. And it's like the friction to creativity is so high because people aren't willing to play with skills as much. That's also something, as I'm now reflecting on it, is a big difference. You know, the people I work with now are 10 times more competent than we were as children. But for some reason, we were able to figure it out. You know, it's not that hard.
Yeah, but I think this idea of play is so powerful, right? It's maybe one of the ways of describing the flow state, where you have the sense of play more than a sense of work. Mm. And I think there are lots of things that could contribute to that. You know, certainly your skill, how much you care about the challenge at hand, how much you feel supported, the support versus challenge balance. But one of the things that we think about a lot in terms of keeping you in that flow state and giving you a sense of play is not breaking collaborative flow. Mm-hmm. So if you have an idea, you pull in somebody else to talk, you pull in the third person, you go back to working on your own. Can you do all of that in a couple clicks rather than slacking out a Zoom link and then waiting a minute for Zoom to boot up? And then where's the other person? Oh, I don't know if they're free. You know, friction isn't just extra seconds or minutes. It's actually breaking flow.
Yeah.
And that's why we pushed so hard to reduce the friction and why I think the reward of that is not just that people are more efficient. It's that they actually have conversations they wouldn't have otherwise.
Yes.
And they stay in flow when, you know, otherwise they would have their flow broken. Or they have moments of inspiration that they wouldn't otherwise. That's so worth, you know, working on and pushing forward.
I'm really now starting to understand why you summarize your solution approach as reducing friction and increasing presence. I very much relate to that when the friction is high because you have to break flow, whether that is scheduling the meeting or there are many conversations that just aren't had. And that's a problem that we have to resolve. So with that, I think I now have a pretty good, interesting idea of your overall approach to this. So as we can get into some of the example use cases. So the first question or the trade-off that I wanted to explore with you is the different apps you can use. So specifically the road of asynchronous communication versus synchronous communication. How do you think about writing something on Slack versus talking to someone in tandem?
Asynchronous communication and synchronous are essential. They're both essential for an organization, for a company, for collaboration. I think one way to think about it is to think about the company as an organism, as a living, breathing thing mm-hmm. that learns, right? And the asynchronous communication, that's like your long-term memory, mm-hmm. right? That's when you write things down, they need to be retrieved. especially when we talk about documentation and documentation practices. Mm. It's how you make sure your learning engine is moving forward like a ratchet and you're not taking steps backwards,
yeah.
and that you remember where you came from. Now, synchronous communication, that's like your nervous system. Mm. That's where you react quickly, where you process things, where you imagine things, where you run simulations, the center of creativity in some ways.
Yes.
And that's where you need this synchronous communication in order to function. One doesn't work without the other. You can't replace all your documents with just talking. And with very few exceptions, unless you drastically change your culture and the nature of the people at the company, you can't replace talking with documentation.
No.
I've forgotten his name, but the GitLab head of remote mm-hmm. put it very clearly in the guide. It's like, the goal is not no synchronous communication. The goal is the right synchronous communication.
Yes, because you don't want to waste your time having a conversation that should have been documentation. I can see that. Darren Murphy, he is definitely brilliant on this. So I get it now. That's a great model. So you basically talk sync about things that are, it's like short-term memory in your brain, and that is generative, and we're sort of like you're doing some kind of co-creation exercise.
Yeah.
But if you're just writing it down, you're supposed to remember it in a particular way that is probably best done asynchronously, correct?
Yeah, I like they use the word co-creation. For high-performing teams, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're co-creating something, and there's value in lots of parts of the process. There's value in the transfer from synchronous to asynchronous, in writing things down. Just the act of writing things down is thought. And then conversely, like when you go from a written document to then discussing it, like think about the Amazon-style meeting where you read first and then discuss, there's value in making something that's written and fixed come alive mm-hmm. and become synchronous and exist in everybody's minds in the room.
When thinking about co-creation, I mean, I said this as we were talking before, sort of like as a joke, but I find it a bit interesting for some reason. I mean, it's a strange thought to have, but I do have this like eerie, you know, poetic sense that we're like drifting into becoming a hive mind. And maybe, you know, you can claim, oh, we already are. And I mean, we're smartphones, we're this grand global cybernetic organism, maybe to some, you know, it just depends on how you sort of slice the pie and analyze what does it mean to be an organism or something like that. But at the same time, that also seems a bit ominous because you want to retain people's uniqueness and individuality, ironically, because that is good for the hive mind. But... So that was a bit neither here nor there, but do you have any reflections on that, like how to be a hive mind versus retain individuality?
I actually like this way of framing it. I definitely think so. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. It's like we are all cyborgs, right? We have part of our brains in written notes. Similarly, like when we collaborate on things, we don't know all the pieces of the puzzle that we're trying to solve. Mm. Often, other people know the pieces. And sometimes they put the pieces on the table so everybody can touch them. And sometimes we rely on them to know the pieces. To some degree, each of our brains is distributed amongst the people we work with the closest.
Yes. So in a way, a little bit of my brain is in your brain if we work together.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Even now, like I'm learning new things from how you describe things and your experience, and your experience and the way you frame things is reinforcing my experience. And together, we're on this exploration. One of the things that your framing of this as the hive mind calls to mind is, I love analogies. We love metaphors. As a founding team, you know, we created the virtual office and we think a lot in terms of metaphors. So for example, one metaphor we think about a lot is the glass office, an office where you can see through all the walls. You know who's talking with who. It's bright, it's sunny, there's a sense of excitement, and you see people moving around. But people can have private conversations. The doors can close. There's nothing indiscreet about it. So that's one metaphor we like. The other metaphor that we talked about earlier that I really like is the company as organism. And when you talk about the hive mind, one of the things that occurs to me is, you know, we can push this analogy further. What happens when the hive mind goes from having myelinated sheaths to unmyelinated sheaths? Like when we go remote and it's hard for all the neurons to talk to each other, but everything just slows down. Everything becomes a little bit more sluggish. And, you know, maybe we see that in how it's just slower to build trust among people. And again, trust or psychological safety is the greatest determining factor in an organization's speed. Another thing that I love about this metaphor is, I'm going a little out there, but I think high quality collaboration, like being in the state of dual flow, with another person that you're working on a hard problem with. So high quality collaboration is like the REM sleep, you know, for a company. You don't need a ton of it. You don't need it all the time. You don't need to spend all day in meetings, but you need these moments to have a sense of shared creativity, to have a sense that you're a team and to move fast with trust. And I think this is one of the things that's become really hard to recover when you go remote. And I think thinking of it like REM sleep allows you to think more creatively about how to get it. You don't need to have it all the time. You can do exotic things like polyphasic sleep, right? You don't need to follow conventional patterns of sleep, but you do need a certain amount of REM.
Okay, so that's a good one. So you need some of this high octane co-creation activity, you know, in a company. But to do that, you need trust and you need the tools to do the collaboration. But to go in on the trust part, that's another problem that I think a lot of what we're talking about here can help alleviate. But how do you think? How does trust get built in a remote team?
You know, I think it gets built through talking with people and working on hard problems together. And I think that's the simplest way to understand it. And then, of course, it's so different depending on your team, your culture. But maybe one way to approach it is to go to the research. There's a paper that I like to share with people from Northwestern called Being There Versus Seeing There, where they actually study trust and how it's built through a sort of iterated prisoner's dilemma game. And they measure in-person versus video versus voice versus text. And you can actually see the different rates of trust being built. And so that's one dimension of it. It really is how much you're communicating with people in a high bandwidth environment. And, you know, at the organizational level, I think it looks very similar. It's about how high quality is the communication? How flexible is the communication for the organization? Man, it's so dependent on your company, your culture, your team. There are many ways to break it down. And I think there's a lot of ways to approach it. How do you think about trust?
First and foremost, I indirectly think we've done something incredibly right in Safety Wing, which is we built our internal company culture document based on Karl Popper's theory of knowledge. You know, this seemed right to me, but there's more in the framework. But we kind of like rewrote it into like a very normative Q&A type thing with three key assumptions at the beginning. And those three are, number one, people make mistakes and that's okay. Number two, improvements are always possible. And number three, all problems are solvable, you know, with the right knowledge and within the laws of physics. But number one there, we harp on about quite a lot, and that is in our culture. That's the culture we want to make. And I'm realizing as I'm listening to you speak that the iterative prisoner's dilemma, the trust you're building is people, I think, unconsciously run a tit-for-tat strategy. So if you kind of really put heavy emphasis on, you know, the, you know, people make mistakes and that's okay, which means like this very approach to other people and what they say and do, where you sort of always go for the forgiveness option in that dilemma or the cooperate option, then trust gets built much faster. So I do think that that is actually a central, well, I know it isn't Safety Wing, but maybe it's like even more important than I thought it was in this sense of trust building. Because I know in companies I've been at and observed, you know, when this isn't there, a lot of effort is spent trying to avoid blame, you know, and you get this like funny thing. I saw this TikTok video where people are like dramatizing a sort of passive aggressive corporate email chain, right? You know, per my last email. That's one thing I think about trust is just what you said. But, you know, other things I think about trust, I think it's important to be reliable and consistent, to speak openly, share, you know, what you actually think and your emotions, you know, so people can get to know you faster. And of course, that is hard to do if you're starting with an environment where there is no psychological safety. But of course, you know, for us, the founders, you know, we can just choose to be open like that and thereby show that we're not going to, you know, use it against you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think listening to you break it down, two categories are emerging. So there's trust as an atomic unit, you know, one relationship between people. And maybe you could deconstruct that into, you know, how familiar are you with them? How open are your lines of communication? How vulnerable can you be with them? And how clear is your feedback to them and from them? And then the other bucket is trust is an emergent property of a team. And that's where, you know, as you're building a team and, you know, our team's expanded a lot during the pandemic, it's very interesting to think about how do you build that in the best possible way for a bunch of new people. And I think one of the things that's particularly rewarding about working on Tandem is that we can learn from our best customers. You know, so For example, very early on, we saw a team, you know, Paystack, which is Stripe in Africa, listening to music together for hours. And they had a really strong culture around Spotify playlists. And they would listen to music together in the same room. And they actually pushed us to build this feature where we sync up your Spotify so you can DJ for your friends, for your teammates in a room. Personally, that was in a blind spot for me because my brother's a musician. I've played music. I can't really work. I usually don't think to work while listening to music. But it was a really interesting feature. And we built it. We started using it more internally. A lot of teams started using it and asking for even more such features. And, you know, something clicked for us about creating shared social experiences where you can have informal conversation. You can't always force vulnerability. You can't always force collaboration. Sometimes you need to create a low friction way to just work around each other and work near each other, or co-work, as you might say.
So that was lovely. I now am very motivated to go return and keep building the trust in the company. Speaking of which, if we sort of zoom out a bit, there was a couple of other use cases, actually, I wanted to ask you about. I read that you want to emulate eye contact enhancing in a remote environment. How do you plan to do that?
Yeah, so this is really around replicating the social handshakes that we have to talk. So in an office, there's so many ways I can get your attention. I can wave at you. I could Slack you, even if we're sitting right next to each other. I can tap you on the shoulder. I can motion like, hey, let's go into a room and we can close the door and have a one-on-one. I can pull in a third person. There are all of these ways of talking that most of them don't exist when you're remote. And this is the biggest reason why we see this category of virtual office emerging. And just having a virtual office, right? Like in tandem, you see so much of what's going on. You start to recover a lot of these cues. But there are two things in particular that I think are things that we've discovered. So one is the wave feature. So if you want to talk with somebody, you can wave at them. And it's almost like Facebook's poke. It's so minimal and so lightweight and so simple. But it lets you have this little handshake of like, hey, you free to talk? Yes, I'm free. Okay, let's talk. And then the second area, which is a little bit more novel, again, by analogy, if you think about a lunch table conversation with six people, typically it's not a six-person conversation. Typically, maybe there's a two-person conversation and a four-person conversation. And then you overhear your name or you pull in somebody and conversations reform flexibly. So we've replicated that with a feature we call Crosstalk, where when you're in a large group conversation, you can pull somebody aside and everybody else's volume will be reduced. And to talk to a different group within the same room, it's just one click. So groups form and reform at a single click, really flexibly, just like you're around a lunch table. And these are just some of the ways that we're recovering some of the more natural interactions that you would have in person.
So you could like whisper to your neighbor, you know, can you believe these people? Oops, wrong room.
Well, keeping with our principle of transparency, if you crosstalk with somebody,
right,
other people in the room can hear you crosstalk, but at a reduced volume.
Got it.
And their video kind of fades out in accordance with that. So you get this kind of checkerboard effect where you can see who's in your crosstalk and who's not. I'm doing a terrible job of describing it. It's very quick and immediate and intuitive once you're in the experience, but it's hard to relay over over audio.
Yeah. I love that poke wave feature. I mean, that's just brilliant, I think, and will be used so much. By the way, I mean, my assumption, and I know this isn't your area, but you know, when I thought about eye contact, why can't we put the camera on the screen? I really miss having eye contact with people on video.
So there is a company called Tonari in Japan that is making a wall that is a portal between offices. And I've only seen, I think their website just has an imagining of it. I don't think they have a video of a working model, but one of the things they're trying to do is have the camera in the middle of the wall using some sort of more physical technology or semi-transparent material.
Yeah.
So you can have eye contact.
Wow.
I thought that was pretty cool. Talk about pushing the limits of the video technology itself. The closest we've come is like, you know, we do see a lot of people taking our call box and putting it at the top of their screen so that they can have something close to eye contact. That's something we see on calls.
And the last thing I wanted to get from your product is that I also read that you aim to enhance creativity. How do you intend to do that?
Yeah, this is, as startup founders, this is near and dear to our heart. And, you know, I think one of the biggest thing we saw when we went remote and when we started talking with a lot of companies that were remote is this feeling that maybe individual creativity is still there, but group creativity, mm-hmm. something is lost. And I think bringing it back to the first thing we talked about comes down to those moments of shared inspiration, which you can't really script. And there's something amazing about being able to have an idea, turn to the person next to you and just say, oh my goodness, I just had this idea. Like, this is amazing. Or maybe you're co-working quietly, you're working independently, but on something related. And you're on this, you know, always on voice channel. And you just have this idea and you say, oh my goodness, I just had this idea to the room. And people can help fuel that idea. So by reducing the friction to talk, we help recover these eureka moments in a group. And I think it's really that simple. Remove the friction, you get back these moments.
I see. So remove the friction and then creativity flows naturally. So as you use tools to solve some of these problems, and obviously Tandem is, you know, one of the best out there, are there any other tools or practices that you use or can recommend to collaborate with your team?
One of the things I believe in really strongly is using multiplayer tools whenever possible. And I think we see this in the most collaborative teams that are building the next generation of great apps. They themselves use very collaborative apps. So think about what Google Docs did with ushering this era of you can work on a document together. And then more recently, what Figma's done with taking something, you know, design that used to be a very solo game and making it dynamic and multiplayer. And it's expanded how we think about design tools to the point where we do a lot of brainstorms in Figma, and everybody has some proficiency with Figma because my co-founder, Bernat, made a game in Figma called Figma Ninja to help teach people how to use Figma. So shout out to Figma Ninja. But I think Figma is so powerful because it lets you think together and lets you work together on the same thing. And we're seeing this wave of multiplayer apps that's happening. There are multiplayer apps, for example, data science. So for example, we have DeepNote and Hex doing multiplayer versions of Jupyter Notebooks. We've got Replit making code multiplayer. We've got Room Service helping an entire set of companies build multiplayer into their apps. And so this is one of the things that I think is so fascinating and encouraging for building collaboration.
That's really interesting. I have to admit, we actually don't use Figma in SafeDoing, but now I am ready to give it a go. I'm going to give it a try.
It's interesting. My co-founder, Bernat, he said, especially in the early days when Figma wasn't nearly as fully featured as it is now, he noticed that he moved a little bit slower. He worked a little bit slower in Figma because he was used to Photoshop and Sketch after that. But we all realized that we as a team moved faster. And now, of course, you know, Figma's more than ready for your most heavy-duty design tasks.
So as we're coming to the end, we would like to also, you know, look a bit ahead to the future. You know, I find this to be a remarkably interesting space, you know, what you're doing, virtual office space. You know, for the last couple of years, you know, whenever someone has asked me sort of like, what's the most interesting thing happening next, this is the thing I've kind of, you know, and I'm so glad that you're building this, building Tandem to muse a little bit about what's coming up. So, you know, first near term, what happens next with, you know, return to the office post-COVID, do you think?
You know, I think we're going to be in a hybrid future where some people are in the office some of the time. And I think this is optimal. This is what we were designing for when we started building Tandem. This is what we saw pre-pandemic. But we're going to be in a hybrid future, and that creates its own challenges. Having some people remote and some people in person creates this second-class citizen problem or an asymmetry. And that's where it's really important to have something that lets your remote employees talk as easily as the people in person. So there are a variety of approaches. We've got a bunch of features around detecting echo and canceling the echo and making it really easy and seamless to have conversations where some people are in the office and some people are remote. At the organizational level, presence becomes so important. Helping the people who are remote talk to the people who are in the office is going to be even more critical. And there's a whole bunch of other things that we need to learn as organizations and need to adapt our cultures to make this transition happen. But that's the next big transition I see happening. It's the partial return to the office and realizing this hybrid future. And the upside is I'm really optimistic about, although it'll be challenging, because now offices will be really used for the things they're best at. Offices can be more of the creative space, more of the meeting space. They're not necessary for companies anymore. They're more of a luxury or an add-on.
Yeah.
We don't have to use them for, you know, endless seas of cubicles doing independent work that might be better done, you know, individually.
So this might venture into the return of beautiful offices, possibly.
I hope so. I think offices will get just a lot better after this.
And so that's sort of a year ahead. But looking 10 years ahead, do you see as, you know, the biggest, most interesting challenges of remote collaboration, you know, that you would like to see solved? Or, you know, do you see some big technological advancement that you're envisioning or hoping for?
You know, I think there are lots of interesting technological advancements, but the key thing is figuring out how we work remotely and shaping our remote culture. Because then the transition to something like VR or AR, that's actually not, maybe not so significant. If we figured out how to work remotely, it'll just make us better. So when I think about the future of remote work, and I'm even talking the near future, like the next couple of years, there's that scene in Minority Report where people are sharing images and collaborating and everything is so instantaneous and fast. And that's actually what I think remote collaboration can feel like, even in the short term. It feels like the tools melt away. It feels like you can talk with people in an instant, just as easily as turning your head. It feels like you can send documents, data, whatever, between your computers and your phones, and you're actually working on the same thing from different devices. And it feels like when you think about the past week, if you're a hybrid worker, you may not remember which days you were in the office and which days you were remote because they feel so comparable. And I actually don't think that's 10 years out. I think we'll get there very soon.
And I suppose Tandem fit into this future by being the platform, the interface for this way of collaborating. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, thinking beyond Tandem, the virtual office is that. And we feel like pretty grateful to have the opportunity to lead the way here. And I think that if we can make collaboration seamless, if we can bring people closer together, we'll be very happy with that.
All right. Thank you so much for joining this episode. It was incredibly insightful, and I'm sure many listeners will take away things from it. I certainly will find myself thinking about trust more and making sure other people can see other people meeting. I hadn't thought about that as a reason to collaborate, but now I do. And I'm also going to download Figma or start using that. So where can people find out more about you?
They can find Tandem at tandem.chat. And we're also on Twitter. And occasionally I do talks on Clubhouse.
All right. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. For more insights into building a successful remote company, head to buildingremotely.com. There you will find episode notes, articles, and book chapters. You can also subscribe to future episodes and recommend guests we should invite. See you in 2 weeks for the next episode of Building Remotely.